Welcome to another Radio Academy podcast. My name is Christian Hugill, and this is the pod that gives you an insight into how a particularly brilliant bit of radio or audio is made every week, as well as giving you something new to listen to while you're walking the dog, cleaning the kitchen, or stuck on a train, or wherever you listen to your things. This week, we're looking at a podcast series from BBC Radio 4. It asks what happens when tragedy makes you a target. Why would anybody accuse terrorism survivors of being liars and crisis actors?
We got told after the attack that apparently we were actors.
Who are the people telling you you were acting?
It's these people that do all these conspiracy theories.
These are the online trolls that find survivors after the worst day of their life to tell them they're lying.
You know, I'm sat there immobile in a hospital bed and you're getting messages from people saying they're going to hang you.
Laughing about something that is so serious and so serious to all of us that have been affected. It's just despicable what people have done.
In Disaster Trolls, the BBC's disinformation and social media correspondent Mariana Spring investigates how people caught up in the Manchester Arena bombing and other UK terror attacks are targeted with extreme conspiracy theories, online abuse and threats. Mariana uncovers shocking evidence that British trolls are blighting the lives of people in the UK. Mariana starts by telling us where the project began.
I started working on this investigation around the beginning of last summer, and it was a time when we were talking again about the US conspiracy theorist Alex Jones and the cases that were taking place over in the States where parents of children or people killed at the Sandy Hook school shooting in Connecticut in 2012 were taking Jones to court because they wanted compensation for the harm caused to them because of the hate that was triggered by conspiracy theories he promoted, suggesting, for example, that those who were actually killed in that shooting were acting, it was staged in some way, it was fakes. And so I wanted to see whether those kinds of conspiracy theories and that kind of disinformation were affecting people over here in the UK, and particularly survivors of disasters, terror attacks, tragedies. And so I set about investigating it and very quickly started to come across some very disturbing online conversations taking place where parents of children killed at the Manchester Arena bombing that happened back in 2017 were being harassed by accounts that told them it was staged, their children hadn't really died, that actors were involved, crisis actors, all of the same language and the same playbook as those conspiracies that Alex Jones promotes, but much closer to home. And it was after that that I got in touch with some of the survivors and then also started hearing from a whole range of different people who'd lived through terror attacks who reached out to me because I said I was looking at this topic to say this is something that's just become part and parcel of living through a terror attack or a tragedy, and people deny the reality that you experienced often, you know, horrific events that have changed the course of your life. And it's so distressing. But not just that, it was starting to spill out into the real world. And survivors were telling me about how they'd been left frightened and scared when conspiracy theorists had, you know, alleged to turn up at their homes, their places of work, filmed secretly or otherwise them to try and disprove their injuries or to check whether they were lying about what had happened to them. And so it all began from there, really. And I started working on this Radio 4 podcast with Anta Dean, who's the brilliant producer I work with lots, and then also with BBC Panorama, sort of in conjunction with that. And it was really interesting the different ways that the investigation unfolded for those different mediums. And I think for the podcast in particular, we had the space to really sort of interrogate the stories of the survivors, but also why people are drawn into these more sinister forms of disinformation.
These are people who have extreme delusional beliefs, and you are talking to the people who those beliefs affect. Was it a difficult thing to persuade people to talk about this? Because obviously you've got the incident that's happened, for example, Manchester, but then also you've got the result of these people's beliefs that's almost opened a whole new avenue of stress, avenue of horror. Was it difficult to persuade people to be involved, or did people want to tell their story?
It was more often than not the latter, which was that people felt like this is an area of living through a terror attack that hasn't been widely covered or recognised or investigated. And they were really keen that I interrogate what was going on and expose it. And there were some really powerful conversations I had with some of the survivors, one that really stayed with me, where they said, you know, the media can kind of choose not to cover this stuff and be a bit squeamish about reporting on it. But ultimately, that doesn't change the reality for us, which is that we're being harassed online and offline. And it's, you know, it re-traumatizes us for quite a few of them. This just makes it so much harder to deal with what they're already trying to kind of make sense of and cope with. And they really wanted it to be exposed, particularly because they think that that then triggers more accountability. It allows us to hold to account, you know, the conspiracy theorists who are doing this, but it also allows us to hold to account the social media companies and policymakers and law enforcement and everyone else who plays a part in dealing or not dealing with this kind of hate. So I was taken aback, although perhaps in this job I'm kind of not as taken aback as I used to be, at just how readily people wanted to talk about it and wanted it to be exposed. And one of the brilliant things to come out of it is the experience of those survivors who have had an overwhelmingly positive response from listeners, from the public, who were shocked to hear about the tactics being employed by these conspiracy theorists and the lengths that they were willing to go to. And also it's reduced the platforms and the reach of the people who were pushing those conspiracy theories. The main disaster troll that we investigated, his YouTube channel was removed. So was another YouTube channel. His stall where he was selling books and DVDs, some of which kind of pushed this theory that the Manchester Arena attack was staged, and very forensically and specifically sort of unpicked the reality of these survivors' stories. That stall's been shut down. It's something that we grapple with a lot when we do these kinds of podcasts. You know, how much do we risk amplifying dangerous conspiracy theories to an audience who might never have heard of them before versus the public interest of interrogating the real world impact that this kind of disinformation can have.
And as someone who's had absolutely no involvement in this and merely as a listener who thinks it's a brilliant piece of work, I would add that you're reflecting where we are with modern society. This is a reality of what's going on. And it's the job of journalists not just to sit down and go, oh, well, we'll leave it to the system and we'll let the system flush it out. Journalism does more than that. Journalism investigates and exposes. And the minute you just sit back and say, well, we'll let the system deal with it, well, you're not bothering with original journalism. So no, I think you're doing exactly the right thing. And you did mention there, Mariana, doorstepping. And we spoke just before we started recording in one of your previous podcasts that I managed to binge through completely on a plane, which was Death by Conspiracy. There's a similar tone in that you do put yourself out there. You are not investigating these issues from the comfort of a Radio 4 studio and a coffee machine nearby. You are doorstepping, you are out and about, you are in these communities.
Hi, Richard. It's Mariana Spring from the BBC.
He sat behind a desk wearing a black t-shirt with his website logo. There's a very brief second where his expression is open, almost welcoming, before he sees the camera behind me and his face drops.
I've been in touch about a podcast and a panorama that we're doing, and I wanted to come here to get some answers to some of the questions that I'd asked you. I wondered if you'd be up for answering some questions.
No, thank you.
Why don't you want to talk to me?
I've already explained that in my email to you.
Do you not want to talk about the evidence? Talk about
No, I don't want to talk about anything.
Can that be nerve-wracking when you are doorstepping people who you know, albeit you are doing it in a very amicable way, and that's clear, but you're still putting yourself at risk, you're still putting yourself in what I imagine is a nerve-wracking situation?
Absolutely, and you really have to, you have to be so prepared for particularly those moments when you're either, you know, doorstepping someone who's been promoting these kinds of conspiracy theories, or you're attending a rally that is, you know, pushing that kind of disinformation, or you're, you know, you have to really, and you know, I have unfortunately a lot of trolls from within the conspiracy movement, many of whom target me quite repeatedly and ferociously on social media, and you know, one of my biggest fears is that spilling off into, you know, offline violence in any kind of way. So I think that, you know, we have to think really carefully about when I attend these things and how I do it. But also I think it's crucial to be able to talk to people, and as you say there, I always really like to and so did the kind of teams I work with, come from a point of empathy. Like, I genuinely want to understand and I want insight into why people are doing what they're doing, but I also have to hold them to account. And I think actually that kind of shouty, angry, you're wrong, I'm right approach just does not work when you're investigating this sort of area. And it doesn't work. You know, it's not the same as holding to account a prime minister or a politician. These are different kinds of people often. And so it's about really kind of trying to both understand and interrogate. And when it came to that doorstep in particular, we had to, you know, the amount of thought that goes into what we're going to ask and how we're going to do it is phenomenal. Because also, you know, this particular disaster troll, his tactics involved effectively doorstepping people who had survived UK terror attacks in a way that was, you know, totally against our editorial guidelines and with the purpose of checking whether they were lying about their injuries, not announcing who he was, secretly filming them, you know, all kinds of things that just we would absolutely never do. But it was so important, and particularly in the podcast, to explain that to the audience and how that doorstep we do is so carefully thought about and, you know, entirely with the purpose of being able to, in the public interest, ask questions to this person who is causing very serious harm to the survivors and whom was not willing to engage with us when we sort of tried to do an interview with him and when we sent over our list of points that we wanted to ask him about. And so you really, you know, you have the weight of expectation on your shoulders when you're going up and doing that kind of doorstep. You have one chance to ask the questions, to get the answers for the survivors in particular. And you're facing someone who you imagine is not going to like you very much, both because you're asking them those questions, but also because I've become somewhat of a sort of, I don't know what the right word is, I've become somewhat of a villain in the UK conspiracy movement. And so particularly those who are very involved in it don't often want to talk to me. But the flip side of that, interestingly, is that sometimes they do want to talk to me. And I always find that once I've met people and I've spoken to them, on the whole, you know, aside from doorstepping, but more generally, if people agree to an interview with me, they don't tend to send me abuse anymore or send out hate or target me in that way. And that always sort of reaffirms to me, at least, the importance of real world, kind of like actually going and meeting people and talking to them, and certainly not sitting it cozily in the BBC and sort of just, you know, giving people a bell and not actually going and meeting them. I think that it makes such a difference to the kind of quality of the reporting and the podcast in particular, when you're really wanting to draw out that kind of empathy and understanding. And you let people kind of breathe and speak for themselves, and you want to challenge them, but you don't challenge them so much that you don't give them the opportunity to respond and say what they have to say. And when it comes to not the leaders of these conspiracy movements, but the fans. So for example, there's a fan we interviewed as part of Disaster Trolls, who was a really lovely woman who has, you know, been entertaining this kind of disinformation and who particularly liked the disaster troll in question.
There's still one online source that she particularly likes.
I like Richard D. Hall. He's quite interesting. He talks about things that other people don't speak about.
But what about the kinds of claims we've been investigating? That terror attacks, like at Manchester Arena, are hoaxes, and that survivors are crisis actors. She's on the fence.
No, I honestly keep an open mind on that. I don't say I do and I don't say I don't, because I don't know. You can't say either way.
What would it take, though, for you to think, oh, actually, it definitely wasn't actors, or it definitely wasn't a hoax?
I don't know one way or the other. I hope not. Oh, gosh, because if that was the truth, that would be awful. You know, it'd be terrible. Do you know what I mean?
You know, she was absolutely lovely. And when I challenged her on those beliefs and kind of said, look, I've interviewed survivors and their injuries are very real and they're very distressed by these tactics and these conspiracy theories, she was really sort of shocked, and it showed you how these beliefs are not as deeply held as you might think. And actually that it didn't take much. It just required a bit of human connection and kind of snapping her out of that bubble and saying, look, hang on a second. You might be rightly asking questions of the media and authority and everyone else, but that doesn't mean that this guy's telling you the truth. And actually, here's the evidence I found from investigating this. And I was so happy afterwards, because she messaged me to say, oh, thank you so much. I really like the podcast. I really like the Panorama. And you always worry with, you know, particularly people within the conspiracy movement you interview, that they might not be happy afterwards. And you want to fairly represent them while also holding them to account and asking them the right questions. So it's a complex world to navigate, but it's really vital to do that. And I think actually, it's our inability to do that, or our our worry about doing that that has limited journalism in this area and actually made it feel very us and them. And that contributes to this problem where people think, oh, I'm going to believe, you know, this person who's telling me that this wasn't real or this was staged over trusted media sources who've spent hours and hours investigating something just because I don't trust the institutions anymore. And so, yeah, here's where I'll turn. And if I can be some kind of lifeline sometimes to some of those people, I like to think that maybe some of the fans of this disaster troll guy will have listened to the podcast or watched it, even because they thought they'd hate it, and actually have listened and thought, oh, hang on a second. You know, I have the agency to investigate this myself and to make my own mind up. And actually, maybe this guy is misleading me. I shouldn't be, you know, blindly following what he has to say.
Just finally, Marianne, on a more broad point, while we've got you on the Radio Academy podcast, looking away from this particular project, difficult to know how to put. I found, as a national BBC journalist on a, you know, on a station that had a lot of listeners, certainly post-Brexit vote, that the news became more divisive. And I found it, as a journalist, I found it more tricky to be a journalist when you're being accused of bias from both sides, when people are hunting you out on Twitter. And I imagine that what I received was a fraction of what you received. As you rightly point out, you know, for those that are in this era of mistrusting the BBC and you are the BBC's disinformation correspondent, you're almost the poster person for this sort of belief. Is it tricky to deal with personally? Oh, you know, it's a tricky time for a lot of journalists. How do you deal with that?
It's not easy. I absolutely love doing this job. And I think that being driven by the, you know, wanting to investigate these worlds and wanting to expose the real world harm that disinformation and trolling and social media can do is what keeps me going. I think that the trolling and the hate and the threats and the abuse I've had to tolerate as something that no journalist should have to put up with. And I've actually, my favorite way of dealing with it has been to, you know, investigate it myself and to actually, you know, investigate and expose and attempt to hold to account often the places that aren't doing enough to protect not just journalists targeted by trolling in this way, but by loads of people across society who are targeted in this way. And, you know, if they're not protecting me, then they're definitely not protecting the average person who's exposed to this kind of stuff. And I found that a really helpful way of dealing with it. I think that I have become more desensitized to it as time has gone on. It's really interesting because I'm investigating Twitter right now and sort of the rise of, or, you know, questioning and interrogating whether there's a rise in hate and disinformation and looking at my own hate. And I've kind of anecdotally feel like there's been a bit more hate recently, but obviously I've got to sort of bottom that out and interrogate, well, you know, is that really the case? And I just noticed compared to when I first did an investigation into my online hate, which just felt, you know, I feel like I was much more likely to have a little cry or like be like, oh God, this abuse is horrible. I feel so much more, I'm so much more used to it. And that's not necessarily a good thing. It's certainly a way of cracking on with it. But I think I hope that the one thing I can do is just continue to investigate and expose and interrogate it and talk about it. And particularly when I talk to people who are looking to become journalists, young people, students, I often say to them, which I'd emphasize again, I would never want it to put people off. In fact, it absolutely shouldn't put people off, and they should definitely, they shouldn't be scared of it. But it is unfortunately something that comes with being a journalist, particularly in this field and particularly a reporter that covers these kinds of topics. But across the board, you know, there are journalists who have to put up with terrible racist and homophobic and all kinds of other forms of hate. And, you know, that's not to say even, you know, the people operating in Russia or Iran or other countries where they are literally very, quite literally persecuted for doing their jobs. And so I think all we can do is kind of, all I can do is keep covering it and talking about it like this. And I think that's a really good way of making people aware that this goes on and the impact it has. The stuff I really don't like is the stuff that makes you fearful for your safety. You know, it's like just the other day I walked out of the BBC and there are some kind of anti-lockdown, anti-vaccine protesters who were protesting outside, and someone kind of said, oh, Mariana, quickly go into Cafe Nero, which is on the side. And I kind of popped in and they said, oh, they're chanting your name. And it's, that's just like really unnerving. You're like, oh, okay, can I get a coffee or should I go back inside? And I'm lucky to have lots of support from the BBC who are, you know, experienced in dealing with this kind of stuff. But it also is a new terrain. And I think even they've been taken aback a bit by just how sort of like vitriolic and nasty it can be. And I think it's just vital that people understand through all my reporting, but also linked to this online abuse, that what happens online is definitely not contained online. It's not this other thing that doesn't affect our world and all of us. It absolutely does. And understanding the real world impact it can have is just crucial, both in terms of trolling and hate, but also disinformation and more. And so I hope that more and more people are becoming aware of that and sort of willing to speak out about it. And it's not a weakness to say, oh, actually, it's really nasty being called all horrible names under the sun. I don't really want to be anymore.
A huge thanks to Mariana. Disaster Trolls is such an important listen. It's available now on BBC Sounds. I thought it was especially interesting hearing, well, just what Mariana and the team considered before deciding to shine a light on these issues, and also some of the realities of being a journalist in the social media age. Now, next week is my penultimate Radio Academy podcast. I'm going to be passing on the baton to a shiny new host in February, and I'm going out on a high with two final shows. In a couple of weeks, we're with the team behind one of the most successful podcasts in the country. And next week, another podcast. This one gives a truly unique insight into life in prison. It is absolutely fascinating. I look forward to talking to you then. Bye for now.